Hello, this is Alex Romanovich, and welcome to Global Etch Talk. Today, we have a very special guest, Talila Millman. Hello, Talila.
Hello, Alex. I'm so happy to be here.
We're very happy to have you. Today is December 19, 2023. We're almost done with this year, and we will talk about some really cool topics. Talila is a very interesting guest. She's a managing director and chief technology officer, advisor, and transformation leader. And that goes for organizational transformation, digital transformation. We'll talk a lot about artificial intelligence because that's a topic that everybody's talking about. But most importantly, we'll talk about innovations and her new book, which is very, very interesting. And we will discover some steps leading to organizational transformation that not only will touch large organizations, but also will be very applicable to startups, early stage companies, and mid-sized companies. But first, Talila, let me say a few words about you. You have been in the technology field for a very long time, and it'll be very interesting to talk about that topic. You were a divisional CTO for private companies, Fortune 500 companies such as Stanley Healthcare, Black & Decker, Harris Systems, and many others. You know, I even noticed Motorola in your background.
Yes.
Which is very cool. We'll talk about the BlackBerry movie as well. I don't know if you saw it, but that's a very interesting one. That's okay. Talila was involved with very large, very scalable projects, but she is also advising a number of early stage companies, very innovative companies. So she has the chops. She has the digital experience. She has the organizational experience. She's an advisor. She is a mentor. She's a coach. Welcome to our studio.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
First question I have is, wow, you know, you've accumulated so much in your background. How do you find the time? How did you find the time to do all of this? And is there some kind of a secret sauce that Talila has that can be shared with us?
I think the secret sauce is really enjoying what I do. I always felt when I come to work, when I start my day, I'm always excited about what's in front of me. It's not that everything that I do is fun or everything that I do is at the moment is fun, but what I find is that I always feel that I have, I always feel a sense of purpose. I've always felt that I was doing something important, that I'm helping important things come to the world. So when I advise companies, I work with very brilliant entrepreneurs that have things that can actually work. I work a lot with cybersecurity companies, for instance. And you know that cyber is one of the most acute problems that can hurt companies, that can hurt the world. I don't know if you saw, there is a movie right now on Netflix with Julia Roberts about a cyber attack, vicious cyber attack. I think
it's absolutely
not such a fantastic scenario. I can see this happening. So helping these companies grow and prevail and bring these ideas and protect the world is something that I find exciting. And I find that I'm doing something important. When I worked with Stanley Healthcare, for instance, we were creating devices to help prevent taking sneaking babies out of the hospital, which I felt I was on a mission to save babies. Or when I worked in Motorola, we were creating messaging systems and enabling text messages. Again, something very important. So whenever I did something, I always had a sense of mission and sense of purpose. And I find that this is, for me, this is a big motivation. And the other thing is that I felt that within the big mission, I personally was making a difference and I was driving things forward. And that gave me the energy and the will to invest and do more and more and do the maximum that I could to make things happen.
You've done work and you've worked for very large organizations. And you now work with a variety of different companies, large and small. And you mentioned to me previously that you meet brilliant young entrepreneurs, brilliant young people, very innovative, bright ideas, you know, geniuses, IQ of 135, 140 and up, right? What do you bring to the table? How's your work environment with them different from a very structured corporate type of setting, if you will?
So this is a great question. I originally thought that there would be a big difference in many things between young companies and more established companies. What I bring, if I start with what I bring to the table, I bring experience. I bring years of doing things. And so I can very quickly and pinpoint what problems are and come up with solutions because I've done these things before. And things are not as different as you might think. For instance, one of the big things about working in corporate is when you have to introduce change. And the change can be, you know, there are a lot of reasons to change things. It may be inefficient processes. It may be a digital transformation. It may be a new strategic direction. All of these require change in the way the company runs. I've done that in big corporations, and introducing change was always difficult, and always time consuming, and it required a lot of effort and energy, which what prompted me to write my book. What I discovered, and there is a perception that young startups and scale-ups are very nimble, very fast, and they can adapt very easily to the market, to customers, to changes. But what I found working there is that they have, you know, founders have a way of working that got them to where they are now. They were successful in starting the company, in raising funds, in driving things forward, in getting the first customers. And that's why they got an infusion of funds. That's how they were able to grow it. But once you grow beyond a certain point, the things that brought you here will not get you to the next stage. And yet, these companies, the founders, but the entire company have a hard time letting go of what brought them up to here and changing in a way that will allow them to succeed. And it's sometimes even more difficult than in big organizations. Sometimes the resistance and the, it's not just resistance, it's the concerns and also sometimes it's lack of knowledge because that's what they did. That's how they succeeded. That's what they know to do. And sometimes they don't even know how to move it to the next stage. And they have a lot more concerns. So, to my surprise, there is it's very, very similar in this perspective.
It's interesting because you actually wrote a book and you created a methodology that you call Triumph. You wrote a book about the entire topic, and it'll be interesting to learn a little bit more about this. Tell us about what Triumph is and how that applies to innovation, to maybe road mapping of your success or your scale or your growth.
So Triumph is a seven-step method to leading organizational change. And basically, I look at the things that get in the way of change. And I address each and every one of them. It's really a roadmap to success. So TRIUMPH is an acronym, and each letter stands for another step. So for instance, the first step, T, is think and get to the root cause. What are you trying to achieve? What is really in preventing you from getting to where you want to be? That's always the first step. People tend to skip it sometimes. They see, for instance, there is a financial shortage. They don't have enough profit, so they cut. But sometimes the problem is not there. Actually, finance is never the problem. It's just a symptom. So you have to stop and figure out what is the root cause. And in the book, I talk about how to do that, how to get to the root cause. So getting to the root cause, the next thing is you have to align all the stakeholders. Now, in a big corporation, that makes a lot of sense because there are a lot of people that participate in decisions. But even in a small company, there are a lot of stakeholders. For instance, you have investors that needs to agree with the new direction. You have customers that needs to buy in. And you have your staff that, you know, was accustomed to success in a certain way, and now they have to do things differently. So align all the stakeholders. I would be ideate the plan. And I'm saying ideate plan versus create a plan, because the important is to come up with a strategy and a high-level plan. And then you use the iterative agile method to continue and develop the plan as you go. So I is ideate the plan. U is unwavering communication. M is mobilize grassroots support. P is put the plan to action. And H is hone the plan, which we already talked about before. So it's a full system, and the important thing is that you have to follow all the steps. Skipping a step may lead to failure of the entire thing.
But it's not only for the large organizations, right? It could also be applied to startups and smaller companies.
Exactly. I apply the same method to small companies, mid-sized company, and now with the startups that I work, we use the same method. As I said, the mobilized grassroots support, for instance, is about getting the support of everyone, all the people in the company. And in bigger organization, I'm looking for influencers, people that are that they can be managers, but can also be first line managers, or they can be just plain engineers or plain salespeople. Plain is not the right word, right? You have some brilliant engineer, brilliant salespeople that other people look up to drive the message and drive the new way. And the same thing applies to startup. I worked with a 40-plus engineering organization that were having problems in getting the product to market. And so they too had to change the way that they were doing things. And part of the change had to do with getting, there was a lot of objections, I wouldn't call it objections. The one thing that I say is that when people object, it's usually concerns. So you have to listen to their concerns, you have to work with them to address them. And once you work to address them and you show how you can overcome whatever obstacles that they think stand in the way, they would buy into it, and they would help others buy into the plan and implement it successfully. So the exact same thing.
You touched on a very interesting topic, grassroots support. Now, sometimes you have a company of five people, right? Or three people or something like this, right? Is your methodology a little bit too advanced for very early stage companies, or does that mean that the grassroots support is going to be a different challenge, and maybe that support will have to come from the community that surrounds this company, or the community that the company has to be involved with or build even in some cases? Is that a true statement?
That's absolutely true. I would call it, I would put it under the stakeholders, because the community is part of the stakeholders that you want to convince and get to support you. I think that's crucial, that's critical. And by the way, you asked me before in a previous conversation, you asked me what is the one advice that you would give the next generation or you would give. And this is exactly, and we talked about community. So this is exactly the advice. Surround yourself, build a community and surround yourself with people who support you and help you grow and succeed. No one can succeed alone. We all need support to reach our full potential. And when you have supportive people in your life, they will encourage you to be the best version of yourself. They will help you grow and develop. They will cheer you when you succeed and pick you up when you fail and share your successes and celebrate with you, help you learn and grow and influence you for new opportunities. So a community of supporters is very important on a personal level and on a company level.
So, you know, one would say, well, you know, it's easy to give advice to somebody else, you know, as a consultant, you know, you're almost programmed to give advice, right? Now, let me ask you a question. What advice would you give yourself of Talila of 25, 30 years ago?
The exact same advice. Building a community and building a support system. This is something that I had that didn't come easily to me. So this is something that I can say now after going through a lot professionally, personally. What helped me through all trials, tribulations, and when I was successful was always supportive community that I built over time. And I'll tell you, I'm personally one of my biggest challenges is asking for help. So I was always very good, you know, I was always very good about advocating for other people. I was always very good asking for help for other people and giving them help. But when it came to me, it was hard for me to go out, to reach out to people, to ask for advice and to ask for help. And one of the things that I learned was how to do that, how to overcome my my internal breaks and reach out and ask. And when you ask, you receive. When you don't ask, in most cases, you don't, just because people don't know that you need this help. So
great advice. Great advice. Let's talk about a different topic. Topic that comes up on a regular basis, and I would love to get your opinion as a woman. You're a member of a very interesting and very well-known organization called CHIEF, which promotes executive women and women, you know, helping women get into the position of power and stay there and share, obviously. Tell me more about that. Tell me more about CHIEF, and tell me more about what you're hearing from other women within the context of changing environment, innovations, technology, artificial intelligence. Is this an issue? Is this something that is this something to be aware of? and something to learn more about, unite, if you will. So tell us more about that.
Throughout my career, and definitely when I started climbing the corporate ladder, for many years, I was the only woman in the room. And the higher I got, it was really just me. When, you know, at the beginning, there were a few others, but then it was only me. And so I really like the idea of a network of executive women where I can talk with other women about the challenges of being an executive, a female executive. And so I joined Chief for the network and for the company of other women executives. What I can say is that I think there are a lot of women out there that are capable. However, I would say that definitely in technology, as a CTO, I would say that what I see in Chief, that there are a lot of women in marketing, HR, legal. There are also a lot of women in technology, but not as much as I would like to see. And let me tell you a story about 2 or 3 years ago during the pandemic. I was working as an executive, and I had a department of mechanical, mostly engineers, mostly mechanical engineers. I had a mechanical engineering department, and we were hiring. And if you remember, during the pandemic, hiring was very tough. It was very hard to get people to join, and we were not different. We were experiencing the same challenges in getting more people on board. And at one point, the head of HR, of course, knew that, right? Because we were working with a recruiter, and I would constantly say, hey, where are the candidates? Where are the candidates? We're not getting enough candidates. And yet, the head of HR called me one day and said, Talila, you're hiring new engineers, and yet there's not even one woman engineer in all those people that you bring on board. And I said, I don't have any candidates. These are the candidates that I get. He was not happy with this response, and I was not happy either. Here I am talking about getting more people to tech, more women to tech, and I'm not recruiting any more women myself. So I did more research, and what I found, and you know, this is from the top of my head, I may not quote the exact percentages, but the percentage of women graduating from mechanical engineering school is around 12%. Maybe a little more, a little less, but low teens. So if 12%, I mean, this is such a paltry percentage. And then I looked at my own group, and we were at about 14% or 15%. Again, I don't remember the exact numbers. So we were actually doing better than the average. So this response made the HR director feel better, but it actually made me feel worse, because that meant to me that it's actually harder to get women into tech. The problem is not even with the companies. The problem starts a lot sooner when young women have to decide their future, and they do not decide, only a low number of them decide to go into tech. So the solution, the way I see it, is in encouraging young girls and then encouraging teenage girls and women to go into tech because there's no reason they can't from a capability perspective. All research shows that they have the same skills. They can develop, they can be as good as their male counterpart. For some reason, they don't choose to go there. And we can spend the entire time talking about this. I research why and so forth. The bottom line, the way I see it, is it has to do with going to schools and speaking and volunteering and just encouraging women to go into these type of positions.
You know, I'm so in agreement with you on this. I have teenage children. One is already in college, but I have a 13-year-old daughter, and she is not getting enough encouragement in school. Yes, there is a computer lab. Yes, there is a exercises, and everything is on, you know, Google Schools, and you know, the homework is done on the laptop or iPad or whatever. But there's not a person in school. There's not a guest, maybe, or there's not a talk to talk about the future. To talk about, hey, here's what you can get as an option. Here's what you can get as a future career as a woman, as a young woman, as a young girl with technology, and how important it is in our society during this time. So yes, I totally in agreement with you. I have another question for you. So we talk about very early stages of development, young women in tech. Now let's talk about another edge of being, so to speak. And let's talk about some of the older generation of professionals, women, not only women, others, you know, men, obviously. Do you see issues inside of organizations with this intergenerational type of relationships? Experience meets innovation. And for some reason, innovation is always being attributed to youth or younger audience or younger generations and so forth. What is happening right now with all of the changes, with all of the crises, pandemics, wars, disruptions, innovations that are causing disruption inside of an organizational workforce, if you will? What do you see inside of these organizations, and how do you think this intergenerational relationships, if you will form going forward?
You know, ageism is a truly sad facet of today's workplace. I was surprised of how true and how prevalent that is. The truth is that, you know, there is an argument in favor of age-based hiring, and the argument that most people do say is that it helps businesses relate to their target market. But this is a ridiculous argument, because if you take this argument to the extreme, a company that develops products for toddlers should employ only toddlers, right? Or mostly toddlers. So this whole argument, I don't think holds water. On the other hand, hiring more mature workers has many benefits. Research shows that performance is not correlated with age. And contrary to stereotypes, mature workers exhibit just as much innovative behavior as their younger colleagues. And the more surprising thing to me is that mature workers are even less resistant to change than their younger counterparts in white collar positions. When I read this research, I found it mind boggling, but I think it's true, because mature workers have the experience of going through many changes. And so they in order to be where they to get to that point, they already had to learn how to adapt. So they are more adaptive than younger people that come up with a certain, you know, concept of how things should be done. And this is like maybe the first time that they realize that maybe things are different and they have to change and they don't know how. So there are a lot of advantages. I think that the biggest advantage for mature workers is really the experience. I know that when I come to a place to advise in a company, my big advantage is really the experience that I bring to the table, right? So sometimes I'm brought for my technical knowledge. Sometimes I brought for my organizational knowledge, my leadership skills. Sometimes in some companies there are entrepreneurs that have more technical knowledge than me, and that's where I bring my experience, my organizational and leadership experience. In other places, there are founders that are not that technical, and I bring my technical experience. But in every place that I bring, it's based on a lot of experience, and that's why I am able to diagnose things quickly and come up with the solutions very quickly as well. I'll give you an example. I'm working as fractional CTO with a startup, a real very, very early stage startups. I was brought in by the board to help the CEO select a vendor, their software development vendor for a SaaS company. And he was like, well, I was working with these vendors for a long time. They know what I need. I don't need requirements. I just need you to kind of, I don't think that he was really knew why he needed me. He was asked by the board to bring me. And after just a few hours of talking with him and talking with the vendors, I realized two important things. First of all, even though he was talking with them for a long time, they missed crucial parts of his requirements and they just didn't include them because they missed it. He thought that they got it, they didn't. And there was nothing in writing because he thought, this is a startup. I don't need to write anything. They'll just run with me. They missed. So really a big thing. And the other thing that I realized is that he was dealing with very sensitive data, extremely sensitive data. So using best-in-class cyber methods to protect the data also had to be part of the initial work plan because no customer would implement this software, would buy this software unless they knew that the data was protected. And again, that was not in the work plan. And the third thing was that in this market, they needed certain certifications. And again, he did not, you know, discuss it. So how did I, realize all these things? It's because I worked with different packages of software, but similar environments. And I knew to look for these kind of things. So I could immediately realize that that's what's happening. And basically what happened was that he agreed. We added it into the work plan, into the statement of work. We did things in a more organized way. And so he got what he needed out of these vendors where he didn't even realize it was missing before. Again, this I attribute it to experience more than anything else. I've done that before. I've worked with vendors before. And I've worked in this type of environment of sensitive data. So I knew what to look for, and he didn't.
Well, we're definitely looking forward to your book, which is going to be published in 2024, early 2024. And I understand that there's an ability to pre-order a signed copy of your book, We will definitely publish all of this information on the landing page next to the podcast when we publish it. So we're looking forward to it. It sounds like it's going to be a very, very interesting read and very applicable, something that could be applied immediately to the work environment for any company, whether it's a large organization that may need more structure, more innovation in certain ways, and vice versa, some of the early stage companies that may need a way out of chaos or a way out of too much entrepreneurship and something that will help them scale better and faster. We always say, you know, the faster you fail, the faster you will succeed. Do you, by the way, buy into that?
Yes and no. The faster you fail, as long as when you fail, it does not hinder you from going on. You know, when we talk about innovation, part of the reasons that companies do not invest too much in innovation is because they're afraid to fail, right? Because they're afraid that they will spend all the resources on the failure and they won't have enough money to invest in things that will get them the revenue that they need. So, by the way, this is something that I also talk about in the book. How do you innovate on a shoestring budget so that you can, what I believe that a company needs to do is that you have to invest in innovation. If you don't innovate, at the end of the day, you become obsolete and irrelevant in the market. But the way to do that is to spend very little on the, and this is where the fail fast, hopefully you don't fail, but if you fail, you fail fast, is you invest a little bit so you can, in innovation, so you can test your idea. You can test it with the market, you can test technically whether it's sound. And then if you, what I did successfully, once I found that the idea was sound and there is market, I got my customers to fund the bulk of the development so that we could continue to invest in the core, but we could, in the meantime, also fund new innovation.
Incidentally, that's a very good question that comes up on a regular basis. When customers do fund part of that innovation, who has the right? Who has the rights to that innovation? Do customers then claim the right to that innovation, or is this something that you're going to have, that you have the ability to claim as your own because you're developing it, but you're developing it based on customer specifications?
So when I say customer funded, I don't mean that they do the specification. If the customers provide you with all the specification, then this is a question just like you say. And part of the solutions, or some solutions that I saw in the past, is giving customers exclusivity for the first, say, 6 months or a year, and then taking it to market. But when I say customer funded, what I'm talking about is a use case where we were the one that specified the product. We were the one that came up with the idea. And then when we had a demo, after we took it, or I should say a prototype, we took the prototype to the market, to our customers, and customers liked it. And so they basically put orders before the product was there. But they didn't have any IP. The IP was ours. So they funded by putting orders ahead of time. And we were able to deliver in the time that we promised them what was our IP. And therefore, they had no rights to it.
This is precisely the wisdom that is missing sometimes with the entrepreneurs. This is the type of wisdom that I would love for us to talk about in the next podcast interview. But unfortunately, we're running out of time. And I want to thank you, Talila, for being such a wonderful guest and sharing your wisdom, your knowledge, your experience. And we're going to find out a lot more about it in your book that's coming up. We will post some information regarding this book. And in the meantime, the audience can reach you at TallulahMillman.com, which is your website. But I would love to discuss these number of wonderful, interesting use cases in terms of how do you handle product going to market? How do you handle licensing? Excuse me. How do you handle the scalability issues? How do you handle the marketing versus product marketing versus product management issues and so forth and so on? Very, very important, very interesting, almost necessary for the younger growing companies out there. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure.